Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
history walk around Glenbrook Lagoon. It used to be, Glenbrook is a little village, so you've got the plain of Sydney, or the sort of, yeah, fairly flat basin of Sydney, rises up to the Blue Mountains, rises up a little bit, a few hundred metres, 200 metres, dips down a bit into a little secret valley. Sort of, it's almost, well, it is a valley there, and a secret valley with a secret waterhole. Very important for all cultures involved. And the centre of this walking tour I'm going to. So yesterday I was very fortunate to go around and jet boat in Sydney Harbour. Great fun time doing that. And then I was trying to think. And then after that I really went into a sort of a little bit of video production. Slowly getting that to come together. Pretty much along the, what do you call it, similar lines to podcast. So I've sort of pulled out of podcasting a little bit to work on that, and now I'm back again, and just slowly working on that. So in this particular podcast, we're going to dice and change. You'll hear a few people. You'll have to actually stick it together. I'll try and put as much connecting material as possible as we're walking up here. Now the little tour, I don't know how many people will be there. It's sort of leaking into social media, so I don't know how many people will know about it. You have to be a local, be looking at local news, and basically, as terms of fullness, they put it in as a footnote. So really, the type of people I expect to be going there are word-of-mouth people, secondary people who've been on the walk before, just coming along just to support, and possibly one or two people who are reading about the social media, in-depth readers. So you've got to have, in terms of your sector, you've got people who read social media, and in that area, people who get a smaller section of it. And even small things like writing up for talks, they've written it up in a PDF, as a PDF document, and the screen readers or the crawlers, internet crawlers, can't pick this up because they put a PNG, I think a PNG image up there. So it looks good, but it's not machine readable, so it's actually a sort of a mystery walk. It doesn't really matter so far, because what we're going to do is actually get the overall, we're going to work there. It's a work in progress as far as I'm concerned. The people doing it are what you wouldn't say antagonistic, they're fearful. Very much remind me of some of the stories of, or from way back, the people long since past us who used to be the first people going to islands or hello. Good morning. People going to islands or areas of Papua New Guinea, there would be this great embracement, enjoyment of new technology, but also a fear of it. And there's still basically this fear. So a lot of the very knowledgeable people, if you put a computer, if you say put on a desk a pen, a book, a mobile phone, a computer, they will know that there's something there called a mobile phone. They'll know there's a computer there. They'll know it's got technology. It looks plastic. But apart from that, they won't know any about it. So the chief person here, very knowledgeable person, the person running this this tour is very knowledgeable, but they're not, what can I say, they're not onto the actual any engagement with the modern world, which is great. It's sort of like they are a piece of history in terms that people lived their lives in historically with no understanding of what the future can bring, or no forethought of what the future was going to bring, which is not necessarily, it's not true for all people. So there's a certain, that really you could line up the History Society from people who can't deal with the future, can't deal with the present, to people who can. And if you had them in a, if you sort of got a room and distributed them left to right, you know, on one wall that way, and then got them to step inward on another, on how much they knew about the past, you get some people who would be really advanced, who could deal with the future in certain aspects and really know a lot about the past. You get people who know about very selected regions of the past, but can't deal with the future whatsoever. I don't know what it is about not dealing with the future. It's this process of giving knowledge. I'm just filling it in. It's but this, what I'm talking about is this knowledge craft, society craft, which sort of sits above the actual knowledge. So how would I describe it? I'm just trying to think about how I would describe it. You need this introduction which sits above the actual history. So we've got the history, and we've got the people's ability to actually understand how they're going, how things sit, and which is one thing. But then you've got a next little level of knowledge to know about how people respond to things. And so I'm writing a research paper at the moment about poor knowledge at school, and the solution to that is to build these social robots which go in and do still do teach the correct content. And when you write it up, it's incomprehensible to the people who have become really content with writing the incorrect things at school. And so you need to pull back and describe a parallel situation which they can get. And this idea of a parallel situation is, in this case, swimming at Bondi Beach in the 90s. G'day. I'd say g'day to the various people as I walk past. And this is great. I can walk up this hill. I've got a little bit of breathlessness, but it's not as half as bad as my peak of my heart condition. Okay, so you've got Bondi Beach, and you've got people who want to have a day out, and there are people out there who are swimming, and they're swimming, a piece of raw sewage come past them. And what's happened is that we've come up with a solution of just pumping our raw sewage out to sea, and hoping that that'll be good enough. And so you've got a situation of people who don't know about that this is happening, people who know that it's happening is outraged. There's a whole series of things, and we're not yet at the recognizing that the issue is twofold. There is sewage, and also people aren't in a mental situation to deal with the problem. So if you're looking back, someone overview would see it's a twin problem. One is that there is a problem of this physical sewage, but there is another problem that the society and the group involved in it have actually built the sewage thing. The reason the sewage is there is because of the society. And the reason it's there is that the people on the beach and the people protesting it there have come out to have a good time. They haven't come out to solve a sewage problem. This is their fundamental issue. So it's sort of a strange thing is there's some sewage there in the surf. You're swimming around a big little mullet, blind mullet, or poo fist comes around and it's there. And it's there, yes, there is an obvious reason, but there is this other social reason, is that you're in there, your ignorance and your, you want to have a day at the beach. Other people want to, their day at the beach involves complaining. Very few people's days involved going back and looking at the engineering, the finance and whatever it is to get the solution in place. So it's hard to say, like, you can work from the emotional reaction side of things, and the fact, and the horrible thing to say is, well, look, it is partly there because everyone's had emotional reactions. They haven't actually planned about what's going to be happening to go forward. So here, I'm going to describe it very well, that the actual problem is the raw sewage, but it's also the problem of people putting it there, not being able to go there. People, part of the, you know, why is someone swimming with poo? Well, it's because they believe they want to have a nice day at the beach. They haven't seen, so their idea, they're really sort of mixed up the problem, because they've got themselves into a mood and an expectation, and there's this cultural disconnect coming across. Hello, little dog. A little cultural disconnect coming across, and they're focusing on that. They're repulsed at the poo, and they're repulsed at this, and they're angry at people. That, you know, they're overwhelmed by a cultural disconnect and want to communicate that cultural disconnect, which is all very good, but at the end of the day, that's not productive activity. It's not productive activity in actually removing it there. And what it requires is an engineer, money, people who are not actually emotionally evolved, or that emotionally evolved, and actually can actually say, oh, well, look, if we put a treatment plant here, we can make sure that the stuff that flows in to the ocean is friendly. If we are indeed going to put wastewater, I do know we recycle our wastewater at the moment, so I don't know exactly what's going on here. Okay, so I'm turning around the corner. It's 5:02, and looking here, and I'll try and do a podcast of this up. I've just turned around the Scarrett Avenue, and I'd say, look, I can see 6 people for this history walk, and you'll come across. So, yeah, getting back to it. Now, it is interesting that there is poo in the lagoon. We're walking around the lagoon, and the central issue is that there's poo, and people are going to be talking to the Historical Society. What they're really important, what they want to do is they want to talk about the history, but they also want to talk about their social contact with history. Now, the very things which mean that they want to do this means that they're the very, not necessarily the people who not necessarily the people who want to solve the problem. Similarly, teachers love kids. They love being able to open up a book. They want to reenact things. When it's not there, it's ruining their day at the beach, and they're quite upset. And they will take it out on a council worker, an engineer, saying, "Oh, well, it's all your fault for doing this type of stuff." Where indeed, the engineer has to talk to them and explain what's going on. So, is this the history walk, or no? It's not the history. Are you going in the history walk or? Oh, don't know. There's a history walk for the lagoon just up the road, and I thought, oh no. Okay. Oh, that might be well worth it to pick it up. Okay, so you're welcome, of course. Yeah. So there you go. And look, there's a fair number of people coming up there. Okay, I'm going to stop this and start it again. Just arrived here and dug the old
print name, sign name, and give me $10.
Oh, unfortunately, sorry, I'll go. Hill. And I have to owe you one. I've got no money.
That's all right.
That's
all right. Leave it blank. We'll sort that out later.
Yeah, sorry, mate.
Treasurer does that. That's not my job.
Brilliant. Okay, so that's Doug Knowles, and there's a little. Sorry, I'm just doing a podcast, so ignore me. I'm just doing a podcast through this.
You do what you've got.
Oh, no worries, mate.
You have to keep up with us, though.
Oh, no, I will keep up. yeah, so I've come up to a ute, and at the back of the ute is some historical stuff. And he's got an old pipe here at the back of the ute, and I'll just read it to you. This is a section of the timber pipe that delivered water from the storage tanks at Glenbrook Railway Station Yard, which was the general facility of this present-day visitor centre. Installed in 1866, the water supply for the steam locomotives continued up to 1913, after which the original railway was abandoned and the new railway was in use. And yeah, it's just tea making gear at the back. All right, Doug.
Historical Society, sitting there with a red and white striped shirt. He's our historian, and we're the only historical society in the district that has a chief historian. And Greg, with the vertical stripes, is another member of our group who'll speak along with us today. So the rest of you, I'll get you to start saying, starting with Dennis there.
Dennis, yeah.
Katrina, Helen, Hayden,
Mark,
Peter,
Tara,
Ethan,
Ken,
Happy,
Doug,
Barbara,
Roz,
Chris,
Kevin.
That's everybody now. I won't be able to remember all of your names. To call you to attention, if I have to call you to the group to attention, I will whistle because my whistle works better than my voice. So please don't be upset about that. A little bit of basic information about the lagoon. I'll go through this fairly quickly and then we'll actually walk around and have a look at it. I've developed a sort of rough timeline on the topic. The first Europeans to know anything about the lagoon was a fellow named James Byrne. And if you read your Blaxland's journal, he'll be referred to as a servant. He was actually employed by Blaxland because James Byrne knew the district as far as the forest area, which of course is Springwood, so he was earning a bit of extra money shooting kangaroos and selling salted kangaroo meat. The next mention, of course, comes from Blaxland, and if you're concerned with Blaxland's journal, he mentions a lagoon with good water and rough, reedy, rushes and rough grass around it. So, of course, he's got to be able to feed horses, so that's important. And then Cox mentioned it when he built the road, and then Macquarie mentioned it when he travelled to Bathurst. And later on it became part of Barnett Levy's square mile of territory in 1832. Barnett Levy was famous for setting up the Pilgrim Inn, which burnt down in 1958. Barnett Levy's square mile, which is 640 imperial acres, don't ask me how many hectares, I don't do hectares, I do imperial acres, square mile extended north of Levy Street, Glenbrook. For, if you can imagine it, the length of Levy Street right out to the railway line extended the same direction, same amount in that direction, and another east-west line drawn, that gave you your square mile. Next thing was 1860, so we're up to 1860 now, and the Railways Department did a survey through here and requisitioned or resumed 40 acres, including the lagoon, because water, very handy for steam locomotives that are very thirsty. 1867, by July in 1867, they've got trains running to Wentworth Falls. There's still no water at Glenbrook because nobody thought to ask for the call tenders for putting in the pipeline. They had the water secured. So here they are with trains in July, no water at Glenbrook. Blow me down. In November 1867, they called tenders for putting the pipeline in. So the situation hasn't changed. It's too little too late. So by 1868, the tanks and the pipeline and the tunnel were completed right through to Glenbrook, and Glenbrook at that stage, Glenbrook Railway Station was right opposite the visitor centre on that level section of highway. By 1913, when they rerouted the railway, water was no longer needed at New Glenbrook, so the railway department departs the scene from here. By 1934, earlier than that, somewhere in the 1920s, the Hudson family built themselves a house over there, sort of weekender house. They had lots of money. They built houses, sold timber, ready-cut houses, all that sort of stuff, the Hudson family. And in 1934, they installed themselves a vegetable garden somewhere around here and installed an electric pump to pump water from the lagoon. In 1946 or so, Bill Ellis sets himself up on the other side of the lagoon and plants a rudimentary sort of orchard, but didn't have a pump, from what I can imagine. It was a low-budget operation, Bill Ellis's operation. 1952 brings us round to carving up of all the land from the pub right around to Mitchell's Pass. And that created horrible environmental problems for the lagoon because everybody had town water, septic tanks, small blocks of land, so the overflow was considerable and all finished up in the lagoon. So everything that had a mouth ate what was in the lagoon and multiplied furiously. So you had the most wonderful bacteria broth in the lagoon. 1972, with the town sewer installed, that made it possible to clean up the lagoon at that point. And later on, earlier this century, the sedimentation traps were built, and that made it even better. So that caught most of the rubbish that runs down the street drains before it went into the lagoon and let the dog poo sort of brew out in the sedimentation traps, and improved the water quality again. So the water quality you see today, I'd imagine it probably wouldn't kill you if you drank it. Wouldn't want to drink more than about two mouthfuls, or you might suffer a minor gastric attack. But it's the cleanest it's been in my lifetime anyway, put it that way. So that's the quick story. So what we'll do now, I'll explain a bit more about the pipeline, and the best place to stand to do that is where the pipeline started. So we'll go that way first. Feels as though it unfolds. That's two pages. Put it the right way round, and you see the tiny little bit there, which is the lagoon, and there's a line going from there down to there, which is where Glenbrook Station is, and it has to go through the crest of the hill, and in that section there's three vertical shafts, two of which are filled in, and the third one is behind me. And that would be the access shaft to the tunnel. To build a tunnel, not a very big tunnel, you can only work one person at each time at each end. So if you want to do it in a hurry, you dig vertical shafts. And down each vertical shaft, you can then work two more men and a third one at the top to haul the rubbish up. So that's how the tunnel goes through the hillside, through the crest of the hill, in pretty much a straight line down to Old Glenbrook Station. And the valve gear to control the flow of the water would be in this pit, and the pipeline goes through the tunnel. The tunnel's not full of water, only the pipeline is full of water. So they do it that way. And that's roughly the position. And with that big slump hole behind me, obviously when the railway department departed, the locals thought, well, nice stone-lined shaft, we'll have the stone. So they took away the stone, and of course the thing collapses, and that's what you're looking at.
There'd have been plenty of stone.
Yes, yeah, so you'd be pulling it apart until you got frightened. The rest would collapse in on top of you.
So all the pipes are still underground?
The pipes are still there in the
tunnel. Except for the bit that you got?
Yeah, except our bit. And it goes down through metropolitan Glenbrook. And when you look at a map of Glenbrook, you'll see that a lot of the blocks of land are not cut off at right angles. They're cut off at a strange angle, and that's where the pipeline is. That's where the pipeline easement is. So much
what
for
diamond a pipe?
It's on the back of the ute, I think 6.5 inches.
Oh, it's on the back of the ute. Oh, that's what that's that pipe. 6.5 inches.
Okay,
right.
Off we toddle. Next stop, down to water in the lagoon. This roadway, you can see lots of rock in here, and that extends out to about the end of the reed bed. And this was installed sometime in the 1960s to allow better access for firefighting vehicles so they could fill up at the lagoon. It wasn't always convenient for them to park on Glenbrook Road because that created havoc with the traffic. So, and they, if they tried to get water anywhere else, they got bogged. So eventually the town council put this stone ramp in. And one of the reasons there's good water in the lagoon is in one 24-hour period, we received over 0.5 metre of rain. And we've had really good rain. About half our average annual rainfall we've had so far this calendar year. So that's one of the reasons we've got plenty of water. So we'll move on from here.
Yeah, there's definitely ducks. So I'm just looking at the lagoon. Heaps of absolutely full. You could almost swim in it now. It used to have lots of swimming. You can see ducks in it. It's beautiful, beautiful view, beautiful reedy from this section. We'll go up and catch up with everybody.
Steam locomotives are pretty thirsty and you use a lot of water, and I asked one of the locomotive branch people, around about 50 gallons a mile for a steam locomotive, and if it doesn't rain very often, a lagoon would run dry. So the engineers decided, oh, we want more water, so we'll build this embankment along so that when it rains, we've got more water. But it didn't increase the catchment. All it increased was the holding capacity. So unless it rains, there's no gain at all, is there? So there were always shortages of water right up until the later days of the railway. So it's fairly safe to assume that these particularly spectacular trees along here spring up from about that time. We do not know exactly when it was, but probably in the 1880s or 1890s. And the causeway, of course, became the road into Glenbrook. Glenbrook didn't exist until the railway went through in 1867. It wasn't even called Glenbrook then. It was called Wasco's, which had nothing to do with Glenbrook, but Wasco's was the nearest habitation, which was Wasco's Inn, just up the road, also known as the Pilgrim Inn. So that's why the early Glenbrook was known as Wasco's. And the request for tenders for the pipeline referred to waterworks at Wasco's. And I told you the date of that. It was November 1867 for that particular contract. So that's the story. The original road level was right down here, and of course in wet weather it gets boggy, and in dry weather it gets dusty, and so that was a much better option. Why the embankment is so crooked is I've no idea. Mostly engineers like to build straight embankments. I don't know. Off we go. Keep going in this direction. Part of the sedimentation or pollution control devices, and there's a bit of a earth wall out there. And periodically they can get in here and reclaim their road making material and all this rubbish. It saves getting it in the lagoon, and it creates a sort of a lake a little bit short of the lagoon where things could brew themselves out and rubbish settle to the ground. And that's what they're all about, this sedimentation. And sedimentation traps, really. What's around is... I'll tell you what they are. I can't tell you much more about them. You can read it as well as I can. I said I'd threaten you with a little bit of information on hydrology. There's nothing magic about the lagoon. If you look at a contour map, you'll see that its catchment extends almost as far as Levy Street in that direction to about the Great Western Highway in front of the pub at that direction, and in that direction, or somewhere out towards Matthew Parade, and in that direction, the crest of the hill just over near the telephone exchange. That's the limit of the amount of water that has ever got in the lagoon when it falls on that territory. However, it doesn't go straight into the lagoon. It goes into the sandy soil, and where sandy soils are undisturbed, there's usually a resinous or organic layer some several metres down which holds the water. So any water that falls on this sandy section soaks straight into the ground. When it gets to the organic layer, it doesn't go right through it and disappear straight away. It runs along the top of it and gradually makes its way into the lagoon. So if you had an accurate enough measuring device, you'd be able to measure the lagoon gaining in height ever so little over the next several months from that rain that we've had recently. It's not connected with the Great Artesian Basin. thank you for the prompt. It's not connected with that. There's no magic springs spewing water into the air, no geysers feeding it, just the underground water that gradually makes its way. And the usual technical description they use is perched mountain swamps.
Oh yeah.
Because they're well above where the water would normally run, and they hold water just by virtue of their shape and size, and the fact that nobody's gone and decided to drain it. That happens with some of these swamps, and particularly around Hazelbrook, there's some rather interesting ones that have been drained in my experience. It was quite interesting territory, the bushland, and then it comes up for subdivision. They put in roadways and drains, the water table drops and all the interesting plants die, and you get an invasion of all manner of rubbish. And you see this happen time and time again when people interfere with the natural environment. Fortunately, around here it hasn't been severely interfered with. It's been bothered at times, but it hasn't been severely interfered with. So the interesting thing would be to record, somebody obviously does, record the level of water in these monitoring holes in relation to that level of water over there, and figure out just how slowly the water table is gradually feeding the water into the lagoon. That's what these are all about. Hydrologic survey.
That do the lagoon? Is there a bush care group that do the lagoon?
You're right, there is. There's a very active bush care group, and they do cleaning up and regeneration work. And one of their projects is the Tortoise Island out there, which you're not allowed to swim out to and harass the animals nesting on it, because the long-necked turtle, which lives in the lagoon area, it has to have land to nest and lay its eggs on.
Oh, and of course, turtles out there.
Yeah, it does. Oh. Once it does that, the local dogs eat the eggs, and you eventually run out of turtles, or whatever you call them, tortoises, I don't know what you call them. They've got the long zigzag neck. Oh. They're the ones that live in the lagoon. So we'll wander down to the water's edge now.
Have you
carp? I don't know.
It was orange.
I know.
They should be here. Mm. But they don't want you to swim out to the island and harass what's going on there. Last time I looked, it had a lot more tufts of grass on it. But I think it's become more a bird perch than a tortoise nest. But
how would the tortoises get up there?
They can scramble on up that quite easily.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that is a huge carp. Oh, I'm so sad.
I didn't see it.
It's a koi carp.
Yeah, it's a koi carp.
Orange and black.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I didn't understand.
A koi.
So we're going to bring a fishing rod for dinner.
In this island.
On the island.
Someone fishing here, he said, I bring you artificial fish so I can feed it.
When they do that, local dogs come down here and eat the eggs.
Artificial fish.
He brings, he goes and gets his own fish and puts them in.
Oh, you must have killed him, wouldn't you?
They did find some.
Oh, no, he...
Not quite, but you're on a mainline.
Well... He and his family had a similar view of people in Glenbrook. So these greenies, I don't know what it's all about.
Good question. How's the tortoise get onto the
These
island?
These greenies.
They're more agile than
you
nuts.
Mean environmentalists?
Well, anyone who lives
I've
up here.
I've seen the tortoise climb.
Oh, stop.
So they were it's pretty amazing to watch it. It's true. It's true. I was here. He was fishing away.
They're quite agile. They just go up the fence. When they get to the top wire, they put two legs over, then the other leg over, and then their body goes over, and then they let go, crash, and they're on the other side of the fence. So I have actually seen an ordinary tortoise do that, climb a 4-foot fence. It only has to climb that high, but it can go over it, so that's they can climb onto that island easily.
Yeah, is that see the head there? Is that a turtle head? Or am I just thinking because you're talking about turtles?
It's
under
a log.
The fence. Is it a log? Is it? Oh,
have you got polarized?
Yeah, it's all right.
If your glasses are polarized, you'll be able to see a lot better.
Yeah.
So the experts tell me.
Yeah. It looks
like you blogged that
So that gives you a good view of the lagoon there. And probably the general view of it from here is rather good because you can't see very much in the way of houses unless you look over there or over there.
Yeah.
So it probably hasn't altered very much in a couple of hundred years, the view from
You're allowed to canoe on here?
Oh, I don't think you're allowed to do anything, actually, you do it just the same if you want to. Nobody seems to care. There's nobody there to lock you up for canoeing there. Swimming is discouraged.
Yeah. Well, you wouldn't know what's on the bottom, would you?
You don't. It's not real good. But as I say, it's better than it has been in decades at the moment.
When I was a kid in the 1960s, we were down here mucking around one day, and I don't know who they were, but they were releasing, I think they call them fingerlings, just baby fish. So they didn't get their boots wet. They said, "Hey, you kids want to let these fish go?" So they let us drag the fish out and tip them out in the buckets.
Yeah, so goodness knows what sort of fish they put in.
Goodness knows.
It wasn't trout because it's too hot. The water's too hot for trout. Yeah. But a long time ago they put those little, I think they call them zambuzi or some name like that, little tiny fish about that long, and they cleaned up the lagoon a lot.
Yes. Okay.
And that happened, my recollection, sometime in the 60s. They did that.
That might have been it.
You can see them over there.
Little tiny fish,
yeah. We call them little guppies.
They're still around.
Here he comes, he's coming in.
So that's the story there.
Don't hear a lot of frogs.
I could hear the frogs earlier when we were over there. We could hear the frogs quite clearly. Anyway, good spot for a picture here. The cloud formation's nice and there's a couple of birds flying around, so what do you expect to see? We'll wander off in this direction now. This is the plan for Bill Ellis's house. And
who was this? Bill Hudson?
Bill Ellis.
Oh, Bill Ellis.
If we get to the Hudsons later.
Oh, okay, yes.
There's the chimp. There's where his stove would have been. And that's the existing room. Apparently he built that first. And here it is, all approved by the town council.
Oh, wow.
There it is. And the approval date is July 1947. And that's for the additions that make it legal. You see this kitchen area with its fireplace.
Yeah.
And the laundry over there.
Oh,
see the concrete?
Yes.
And see the privy over there?
Yeah.
There it is.
Oh.
And the council was quite happy with that in 1947.
Oh, wow.
And there's the plan.
Wow.
And there's a sketch of what the elevation of the house.
Mm.
And here he is with various relatives, probably the ones that have helped him build it.
Mm.
Standing.
Which one's is here?
Bill Ellis is there somewhere.
Okay. Oh, here.
There he is.
There he is, yes.
Now, I'll tell you, I'd tell you why this is a public reserve. Mm. Bill Ellis, we haven't done a hell of a lot of research on.
Mm.
He came over here and owned this land from Glenbrook Road right through to that subdivision over there and the crest of the ridge. And he owned the lot. And I don't think he enjoyed particularly good health. In fact, we suspect he might have been a returned veteran from World War II. Of that we are not sure. We've got members doing research on that sort of thing.
Mm.
But the most important thing about him was, apart from setting up a rudimentary sort of orchard after he'd cleared quite a lot of land in the direction I'm pointing, he never had much money, and he was resistant to paying his council rates. Very resistant, so much that he didn't pay his rates at all. So, of course, the inevitable day comes when he carks and tries to pass on the land to his heirs and successors, some of who are in that photo, but owes the town council a hell of a lot of money. And of course the town council advertised this marvellous piece of real estate for sale. And all the locals said, you can't sell that. So it'd be, the council was eventually convinced. They said, well, what difference does it make to council finances? Several grand, it doesn't make a huge difference, you know, a couple of $100,000. Doesn't make a huge difference to your council finances. You haven't received any money from it for decades. Call it a council reserve, and so it is. So it's a council reserve for public recreation under the control of the town council. So it does not belong to the state government. It is not Crown land. It belongs to us through the town council. Now that's how you got it, because Bill Ellis was resistant to paying his rates. I know he wasn't in particularly good health, and
the council knocked the house down.
Yeah, council, when once they got control of it, you can't have a house on it, so they knocked the house down, and this is all that's left. Yeah. And this is the top of his chimney, to make so that nobody could push it across on top of themselves. They pushed it off, and there it landed. That's nice and safe now. They didn't bother taking it away. But that's all that's left of Bill Ellis's house.
So what year would that have been?
40s. The house was 1947, but he was living here long before that. In the first bit of the first building, he was living in the big bit of it, long before that. And my recollection is that the town council had control of this land sometime in the early 70s, round about then, as I roughly recall. So it's not all that long ago, and the trees, of course, have grown up, and there's absolutely no sign of his orchard. If you blunder around the scrub there, you'll find the remnants of the orchard, a few furrows and a couple of holes in the ground where possibly pipelines have been put in or for some purpose. But after a bushfire, you can see the lay of the land's been altered down in that section. So most of these trees have grown up since the area was abandoned as an orchard.
And he had a wife but no children, did he? Yeah.
That's right.
Yes.
So this information came from his nephew, who at that stage was living over in over in Olivet Street. So we just got the information from one of the relatives that knew we were interested in it. So there it is.
Yeah.
A rudimentary plan, if ever there was. It wouldn't pass today's muster, would it?
No.
It's a chimney.
Prepared to do things for themselves. The Board of Fire Commissioners wouldn't give them a fire station or a fire engine, so they got in touch with the town council and said, what can you do about it? The town council gave them 25 quid. He said, you're to use this for purchasing hand tools and that sort of thing for firefighting. Well, 25 quid doesn't sound very much money. It was well over a week's wage, probably a week and a half's wages for an ordinary worker in those days, so that puts it around about $1,200 at the moment. And they said, well, you can use that bit of land that we've got spare. We don't want it for a substation. It's only 25 feet wide. You can use that. So you can lease that at a dollar a decade or something like that. So they built themselves a fire station. And in my collection of photos, there's one photo with everybody dressed in working gear and a stack of bricks and a wheelbarrow full of mortar and a ladder in the background. And then the next photo you get, everybody's dressed up in collars and ties.
Yeah.
And that's the grand opening ceremony. But when you look at the grand opening ceremony, it's really grand. The grandest people there are the people that did the work. There's no aldermen, no politicians. They did it on their own.
And is that the fire station at West Coast Street? Is that
It was at West Coast Street.
And is that still there?
No.
No, because it's
gone.
It's gone.
It's gone. No, that was part of a land swap.
Oh, okay.
The Anglicans had a block of land they didn't want at Warramoo, and they wanted that block there so that they could expand their Anglican conglomeration. And the town council said, oh, right, we'll do a swap, and made everybody happy.
So which was the block of land that the Anglicans had in Warramoo? Whereabouts?
Oh, pretty much in the middle on the south side.
In the middle on the south side, okay.
Drive in off the highway, head south, and go straight ahead, you'll crash into it.
Oh, that's that one. There's a church still there.
It might be. I don't know.
There's something.
I don't know. I haven't studied Warramoo.
And I'm ignorant. The Glenbrook Fire Station now is?
It's in Wasco Street.
Oh, it's still
west.
Further west. Oh, further west.
Yeah, the fire brigade's just over there.
I've turned up some further information. Who wants a little map? This is pretty much what I said earlier in the day. Some of the dates are not quite right on the one I just handed out. The introduction, I had the dates right. don't worry about that. So we've talked about history, hydrology, old houses and Bill Ellis. Now's a good time to point out trees and other engineering artefacts that are through here. So when you wander through this track, occasionally you'll find or trip over some, you're not allowed to call them manhole covers these days, you have to be politically correct and call them utility access shaft lids. And the sewer from that section runs down through here and eventually finds its way down to the sewer.
Well, are they covering men? They're covering utilities.
They're covering facilities, so you mustn't call them manhole covers.
That's what I'm saying. They're not covering men, are they? They're not really manholes.
Well,
they're not holes that they're burying men in.
Women can climb down the shaft too if they want to.
Yeah.
But you've got to be politically correct these days.
It's not politically correct.
And in the 1970s, when they put in the sewer on that section there, that section of subdivision, the line runs through here. And in part of the revegetation, come and join us, part of the revegetation, of course, was to replant trees. Now, the correct way to do this, which I like to tell people about just in case they don't already know, the correct way to do this is 2 years before you're going to create the environmental havoc, you get the seeds off the trees that are already growing here and you plant them, and then you have seedlings that high in little containers. And then when you've done your environmental havoc, you are then planting the same trees that were here in the first place.
Yeah, sensibly.
But that requires planning. Mm. And this doesn't often happen, good planning. Mm. I know that because I'm a nurseryman by trade. And when I knew things were about to happen, I'd try to grow things in time, and then they'd buy them from somebody else anyway and buy the wrong things. So I gave up in the end. But that's the reason we've got trees like this that you won't see anywhere else in Glenbrook. There's one behind Mark. And there's another one, a slightly younger one there. They're Sydney blue gums, and they just don't belong here.
No.
They look great.
They do.
The trees that do belong here are those. You've got a grey gum there, that one I'm pointing at there. And behind you there you've got turpentines. The turpentine tree has rough fluted bark. And when you turn the leaves over...
Oh, come on.
And turpentine trees around these parts... Come through. Turpentine trees around these parts are bursting into flame during bushfires.
Yeah,
so if you have them near your house, they're a definite hazard. Because the fire runs straight up the woolly butt and sets fire to the crown, and then all the embers fall on your house. So don't have them too close to your houses, turpentine trees.
The main thing I have around my house is just turpentine sitting.
You're a goner. Listen, I can assure you.
I hope you're fully insured.
Doesn't matter what
you need to be fully insured. Let's move a bit further on.
Well,
a couple
all the fire trucks will come to my house for sure because they know the risk. You were across the street, were you?
Well, I was still there.
Caught on fire at some stage. It's a long time since there's been a fire through here. The wood is fairly yellow, and as firewood, it only ranks about second-rate firewood. It's not particularly good. Mm-hmm. It'll do, you know. It rates about 6 out of a scale of 10 for firewood, but it belongs here. Further down there, you'll see ironbark. Here. Right through there, ironbark trees are really good structural timber, and as firewood they get full ranking, 10 out of 10 for firewood. But good straight, yeah, really good hardwood, good straight ironbarks like this are structural timber. You can build bridges and things like that out of them without milling them. Yes.
Please repeat, what is the name of tree?
Ironbark. They're very hardwood tree. They're not just ordinary hardwood, they're very hard hardwood. hence the word ironbark. Fast the water runs into the lagoon, so you've seen the downstream side of one. The first one we looked at, we were looking at the upstream side. Now we're looking at the downstream side, so that's a flow regulator. And all the rubbish that comes in off the street is supposed to settle there. And there's enough moisture there for the wandering dew to thrive. And also that Vietnamese mint The Vietnamese brought that into the country as a culinary herb, and it does very well under wet conditions. Mm. I don't think it tastes very nice, but that's my opinion.
Is this one?
That's Wandering Jew. Mm. And that one causes skin problems with dogs.
Oh.
Mm. So if your dog's skin starts to fall off after they roll around in that, keep them away from it.
Okay.
But it's, it doesn't cause any other problems.
So which ones are Vietnamese
mint? That's it flowering there, okay. See, with a little... Yeah. There's another plantation of it over there.
Okay.
So it's a culinary herb used by the Vietnamese. Nobody else seems to be very interested in it.
And they still now they use it?
Oh, yeah, they still use it. They know how to put it in their cooking.
Okay.
It doesn't impress me. The Melaleucas, or swamp tea tree, as they're also called.
Yes.
And they really thrive in under wet conditions like that.
Yes.
Last time I was here, that area through there was all dry, and I was able to walk out almost as far as that floating weed on solid mud. I'd be up to my knees in it now.
Mm.
So that's Melaleuca lanerifolia. It's a paper bark tree, commonly called, or swamp tea tree. It has lots of names like that.
Is that the Melaleuca honey?
That's it. Melaleucas.
I've never seen it flower, that stuff.
It has a white flower and it'll cover the whole thing when it's in flower.
Is it native?
Little time. Oh, yes. Yes, it belongs here. It belongs here. Here's some young ones. There it is. Crush it and smell it so you recognise it next time. There it is.
Is it the one, I've got a few gums which flower twice. Once and then a few months later, a male and a female.
No.
It's not. It happens in my own thing. It's probably not a gum. I don't
crunch
want to
crunch it up.
No.
Yeah.
Gums
yeah.
don't do that.
You no, use Melaleuca?
I have something
you
that
use
flowers
it? Honey?
Twice.
No.
No, you have eucalyptus that flower at different times of the year.
All right.
That's what you have.
Okay.
And, if you want to bring sex into it, which everybody does, gum trees gum trees have both sexes on the same tree.
Right.
Yeah.
They can change their mind at any time.
That's right. Yeah, they do it both ways all the time. But all gum trees do that. But there are other trees that don't do that. And it's a rather difficult concept to point out to students that with the she-oak trees, it's the females that have the nuts. And that's a very difficult concept for my students to understand.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, they're good.
Yeah.
I think I mentioned in the introduction that in the early 50s this area was subdivided. And if you want to know who did the subdivision, you just look at the street names and then look up those people in the phone book. And their offspring are still living in the district. I think the most famous one was John Hersey. He was one of the local aldermen at the time. He did the traditional thing: if you want to develop land, get yourself elected to the town council.
Yeah,
and it's only this year that the state government is talking about making that no longer possible, which is a very good idea. But why people elect representatives who have their own axe to grind still escapes me.
Yeah.
Anyway, you're looking at modern architecture. None of the original houses are still here, I think. The original houses were much more modest than this style of thing. But it's... they all went in with town water supply and no sewer, so you had small blocks of land, as you can see. So the outflow and the overflow from the septic tanks worked its way into the lagoon pretty swiftly with disastrous effects. But the interesting thing, one of the stories that Tim, our chief historian, tells us, this is how to run a business successfully story. The people that were doing the roads and the subdivisions, their bulldozer was in pretty poor state of mechanical affair and needed a lot of work doing on it. Now there's two things you can do if your machinery is worn out. You can borrow money and buy a new machine, which means you have to get on well with the bank manager. You can borrow money and repair the old machine. The third option is that you can insure it and burn it. And a lot of people do this with real estate. Bulldozers are remarkably hard to burn. So what they did at the end of their day's work, they organised somebody to come back and start up the bulldozer, warm it up, put it in low gear and aim it towards the lagoon and bail out. And as far as we know, the remnants of the bulldozer is still down there somewhere. And it's quite a good way of running a business, because you finish up with an insurance claim, you finish up with enough money to buy a new bulldozer, it saved you the bother of fixing the old one, and it saved you burning it. I thought it was pretty brilliant. Anyway, the people that organised this, their names are still on the street sign, Steve. Now, that information came from our chief historian. If you can work out at that stage, he would have been in his 20s. I was too young to appreciate what was going on at the time, but that's exactly what happened. We'll carry on now, and we walk down through this section. Methods now. There's a house in behind these, which dates from probably early 1900s. It's built using El Cheapo concrete, commonly called ashcrete. You used to take your truck up to Valley Heights Loco Depot and pay 5 shillings, and that entitled you to as much ash as you could. Oh, it really entitled you to 2 cubic yards of ash or something. But as long as you had a receipt with that day's date on it, it didn't matter how many times you went back that day, you could keep filling your truck up all day as long as you had the energy. So you'd get several truckloads of locomotive ash, some sand from the river, and as little cement as you could manage to make it hold together, around about 10% cement, and mix it all together and build a house out of it. Mm. And the technique they used was the same as rammed earth houses. You put 2 planks side by side, and hold them together with bolts, shovel the stuff in, tamp it down, and then move the planks along, round and round you go, then up and up and up, and round and round you go. Don't forget the windows and doors. And when you finish, you can damn near see through it. So then you get your cement and your yellow sand and you render it. And there's a house in behind there. It's fairly low roof line. You won't see it from this street. And it has a 1950s concrete tile roof on it. And it is an ashcrete house with quite thick walls, and it's very old. And I haven't done the title searches on that. It's very hard to do title searches unless you've got somebody in the Lands Department that'll do it illegally for you.
Good.
You can't get the information from the Town Council because the information is burnt. Sometime in the 70s, one of the land developers who didn't get his own way set fire to the council archives up at Springwood, and all the archives were lost. So he covered his tracks that way. Anyway, I've told you a bit about how to run businesses successfully.
Just of interest, the Major Barbara's house is, when they bought that block of land, had an old outhouse and an old shed on it, and they lived in the shed, but the outhouse and the parts of the shed were made exactly that way. I didn't know that. So they probably got that fly ash from Valley Heights.
Valley Heights locomotive ash,
There you go.
Yes, it was quite a good building material, and Bill Ellis would have used it on his concrete floors.
Well, the outhouse was very stylish because it was actually chicken wire rendered with that type of, you know, low-grade cement concrete mixture.
Yeah, well, so you hope the chicken wire would hold the...
Yeah.
It didn't have much... The ashcrete itself didn't have much cohesion.
No.
So your plastering would fall off if you didn't have the chicken wire to hold it all together.
Yeah, well, nowadays you probably see that outhouse on television and as a nice organic sculpture, because that's what it looked like, but it was just roughly done.
It would have been insulated, would have kept warm.
Yeah,
they're good.
Yeah.
What's the term they use? Thermal inertia.
Yes.
You can achieve the same thing nowadays using concrete blocks. But, 8-inch concrete construction. I'm very much in favour of it, and so was my father. He built numerous houses out of it. It wasn't favoured by his customers because it's not fashionable to build houses out of 8-inch hollow block construction. Blue Mountains Council didn't permit it until sometime in the 70s anyway, but they got built just the same, I know, because I built them. I built some of them. But it was cost effective because 8-inch hollow block construction is a load-bearing wall, and you can go to 9 feet high with that. And it costs exactly the same as 4.5-inch brickwork, and that house right in front of us is 4.5-inch brickwork. And 4.5-inch brickwork won't hold the weight of the roof. You have to have a timber frame inside that to support the weight of the roof. So that doubles the cost. So why not, the same cost will give you an 8-inch solid wall, much like the blokes that were doing with the ashcrete. They're building themselves almost a solid wall. They could sometimes nearly see through it if you were careful, depending on the size of the lumps of ash.
Yeah, there was a house show I was watching the other night, and they were using straw and mud. But the wife complained because the mud cracked, and she wanted smooth walls, whereas he was, you know, environmentalist. He said, oh, this is great, you know, it looks good. She said, I don't like the cracks. So he did some paint over the top, but it insulated the house and it was cheap.
Yes,
lined all the walls.
Good thermal inertia.
Yeah, good thermal stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
Good stuff. The problem is the termites eat the straw.
Eat the straw.
And then,
oh,
the mud, then the mud collapses.
Oh.
You can't win.
You
can't win. Let's head it through this one. The wildlife is here, the birds are here.
Mm.
The lizards and the snakes, they're all here.
Yeah.
And the frogs are here, and the snakes eat the frogs, and something eats the snakes, and so
yeah,
it goes on.
That's
what they call the balance of nature, isn't it?
That's it.
And it was just a giant jigsaw for you to put together.
Mm-hmm. There's but a Hudson's at Glenbrook, isn't there? Hudson's?
No.
Penrith.
Oh, the name's still about.
Yes.
The name's still in, the business name is still there.
Yes.
They're hardware and timber merchants, so that's...
Mm.
Well, that's I live here. Some of them live there.
Yeah, well, they don't even sell hardwood anymore.
Don't they?
No. I've been there. No,
hardwood. You've got to buy treated pine.
Yeah. Rubbish.
Mm.
But that's a knockdown. That's not the original house. I mean,
no, that's the original. That's the original.
That is the original house.
That house from the 1920s.
Oh.
If you get up in the street, you'll see it's in behind modern houses. It's got a sideways driveway leading up to it. But that's definitely it there.
Original. Okay.
It's got its gable end facing the street.
Okay.
No other house in that section has.
Mm.
And you can see it, that style of architecture from the 20s.
Mm.
But I think the Ash Creek one further back is probably older. But I haven't done any research on the Ash Creek one.
Mm. Yep.
Foreign tree with its fresh leaves on. It's probably refoliated since the drought finished, since we got good rain, and it's a cheese tree. Unfortunately, I can't show you the little tiny mozzarella cheeses that grow on it.
Oh,
can you spot one?
Yeah, I can see a few.
Little tiny, like those little lumpy cheeses you buy.
Oh,
and that's its main. That's it. That's its main identifying feature. It is an Australian tree.
Does it taste like cheese at all?
It tastes horrible. The birds eat it.
All right.
And
it tastes like cheese.
There's another one up there. It's just the shape of them. It looks like those lumpy cheeses that you buy.
What is the name of a tree?
Cheese tree.
Cheese
they call
tree.
It cheese tree because it looks like those little lumpy cheeses that you buy at the delicatessen, but the fruit is only about that big, whereas the cheeses are that big.
And you that's your designation of it.
That's the chief identifying feature for amateurs.
But you have done. It's your invention.
The name?
Yeah.
Oh no, it's a generally accepted name.
I would have loved it if you've invented it. And I'm
no,
champion.
I don't know who invented that
I'm
name.
The pub that you were.
I've
found another cause.
I've only just remembered its botanical name, and I'm not going to try and pronounce it. It might dislocate my jaw.
Yeah, it's probably something to do with mozzarella.
That's it, yes, that's what I'm talking about.
Little,
good.
There's a little chili.
That's what we're talking about.
I don't believe it.
I planted one in my backyard just over a month ago.
Do you want to? Pumpkin tree.
Pumpkin.
Pumpkin.
I'm going to eat it.
Nah.
Mmm.
Just a word.
It's actually not that bad.
Sign off and write the time you sign off, just write the time that's on your personal watch.
Where's the potential walk next time?
Up a mountain. You've got a program, haven't you?
No.
Oh, wait, I'll give you one.
Yes.
All right, see you, Doug. I've
okay,
got to,
cheerio.
Got
to
go. Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Thank you. It's really interesting. Okay, the coronavirus. Stocking up on medicines for the coronavirus. The end of the world or not, as the case may be. I sort of came in on a conversation at home saying, I'm buying up various cans of food for the end of the world, and quite a sensible person, but saying, looking at the use by date and what sort of cans to buy up, and so people are stocking up for the end of the world with it, and you better stock up on new medicines. And I thought, this is by far the worst thing you can do, especially if your medicines can go out of date. And so they says, have you stocked up? And it's this conversation of whether you do it. You say, yes, I have, in order to actually avoid having a conversation about whether it's really necessary or not. And I have warfarin and a few heart things. So they're long shelf life. And, it could be made in China and blah, 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 blah. And you just think that warfarin, sort of basic heart thinners, I don't know.
There's newspaper articles about how you should make plans for end-of-life care for older relatives in nursing homes. This is in newspapers because when it really strikes, there's not going to be any way to look after them. Sort of how to wash your hands and what to do and how the rest of the world isn't going onto an emergency footing, but Australia is, and we've monitored all our cases up, and I think the thing that sort of shudders people in Australia is that Iceland's got a case of it in terms of you just don't think, you know, Iceland, that's pretty isolated, Iceland. I sort of wonder whether Australia's name could be Isolated Land as well. So there's, you know, huge, sort of biosecurity is in the natural thing in terms of trying to prevent people bush bashing in order to stop them taking germ, you know, funguses in and around the place. And in general, there's a sort of a higher level of attentiveness there. What else? I don't know whether you can get insurance for death against coronavirus. All these complicated things, the world markets going, all the superannuation money going around, and people haven't been as gleeful as the market going up as they were, sort of the same sort of mad gleefulness before the GFC. There's been a quiet stuff going there. I'm just trying to think of these other, the basic things about cleaning your hands. Japan, they've stopped schooling before the Olympics. Japan is staffed. You're not going to have anyone, an Olympic stadium with just no one turning up. Was it, there was a Tour de France and a bike race where most people tested. And, you know, this amazing thing, they can test it, and just requires little increments in technologies. This is a vaccine. Can you imagine the sort of spread of things about the amount of time for a vaccine to come up? And I think sort of China's learned its lesson. Hopefully we won't have a second COVID virus coming out. And sort of, I think, the sort of feeling of the totalitarian state, one aspect is that they've suppressed it, but then there's all these things they wouldn't, if they didn't, China's wealth is built onto totalitarianism, that is, it's been able to enslave itself in order to, you know, it was ignored and it's turned itself into a slave nation, self-imprisoned itself. I mean, it's, you know, it's almost China's own business. They've got such a dreadful human rights and stuff like that. It's not something that I necessarily am all that judgmental about, but it's something they've got horrendous wealth, knowledge. I don't know. For me, I don't. Do I have pride about being an Australian? Not really. I'm sort of more ironic, sort of feeling. I sort of do feel that I would like to at least add a note of positiveness to the world rather than actually conquer it or influence. I'd just like to be a positive influence to the planet, which is sort of like a sensible approach to take, because the planet's got limited resources, and I just don't think people appreciate sort of culture's okay where it exists, but extending it beyond its natural boundaries is sort of a bit of a hiding for nothing. I know that this doesn't make very much sense, but there is a general sense of getting ready for the COVID
outbreak. So what is it? Shutting down schools, shutting down public gatherings, setting out barriers, checkpoints. Like we've in Australia, we've got a fence which goes across the world's longest fence. The world's longest barrier is not the Great Wall of China. The largest walls are dingo fences and rabbit-proof fences they have across Australia. So there are these quarantine lines. So the introduction of various quarantine lines, I just don't think will happen. We don't have sort of the very large homeless populations. We do have people beginning to really crowd into public transport, but yeah, I don't know how it will happen. So China's shut itself down. I don't know what will happen to Australia, but so far there's you know, mercifully, hopefully we'll get more methods of treating and understanding it by the time it gets here. And I think the major thing is to work out who's at risk and try and actually focus. Like, if healthy people don't die from it, you know, healthy people don't die from it, it means that you can really focus on trying to help these people. Hope that helps. Put this up as a podcast soon. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.